There is a double cup, a Goetia cup in there.
Great, thank you so much. Very good. So we're on Daf Lamed Aleph. Daf Lamed Aleph, Lamed Aleph. And we're moving towards the end of the Amud. Let's see where we can start here. So we're looking for a line in the Gemara, Amalo Havei Edim. It's about four lines below the Gemara, which follows the Mishnah. Mm-hmm. And the Mishnah says that if they approach the litigant and they ask him, do you have any testimony, do you have any evidence? And he says no. And the Mishnah says, once he says that he doesn't have evidence, then we no longer can accept evidence, even if later on he claims he does have evidence. That's according to the Tanakhama. And Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says, what happens in a case of a person who couldn't find witnesses and now he found witnesses, or he didn't know about the witnesses and now he finds out that there are witnesses? So he says that we should allow him to bring in his testimony, his evidence, even though initially he had denied that he had evidence. But the Tanakhama disagrees, and the Tanakhama thinks that something's very fishy going on over here. How is it that initially he said he has no Edim, and now all of a sudden he has Edim? There is one case where even Rav Gamliel thinks even Rav Shimon Gamliel thinks it's a little bit odd. It's a little bit suspicious. Because when Beis Din is about to issue their final verdict, and they're going to find him Chayev, so all of a sudden he looks in the audience and he says, oh, let these two witnesses come forward and they'll testify on my behalf. Or all of a sudden he pulls out a shtar from underneath his garment. So here even Rav Shimon Gamliel would agree that we suspect that he paid off these two witnesses, but he was hoping he wouldn't have to utilize their services. But then he saw that he was desperate. So the Gemara says the following: Omar Rabba Barafunam Rav Yochanan Halacha Kedivrei Chachamim. That in this case, where there's a debate between the Chachamim and Rav Shimon Elazar, Rav Shimon Gamliel, about the case where initially the litigant admitted he had no witnesses. So we pass him like Chachamim. That's what Rabba Barahuna says. And that means that he's not allowed. We will disqualify any evidence that he brings in later, because he himself, by his own admission, didn't have that evidence. Now, Rav Barafuna makes another statement, which seems to be repetitive. Omar Rav Yochi says, "Ein halacha ki Rav Shimon Gamliel." Right, Rav Shimon Gamliel says that if he found Edim, maybe he found Edim and he didn't know about them. So why is it that we need Rabbi Baruch Huna to tell me that the halach is like Chachamim, and then he has to add Ein halacha ki Rav Shimon Gamliel? I mean, once you've told me came in the Yomar halacha ki Divrei Chachamim Mela Yadin, I know the Ein halacha Rav Shimon Gamliel. So what the Gemara is going to do now, this was the last Gemara that we learned yesterday, but just to review this Gemara, the Gemara is going to say that what Rabba is trying to emphasize is lafuke. In other words, only in this case we don't paskin like Rav Shimon ben Gamliel, but in all other cases we paskin like Rav Shimon Gamliel. In all other cases, what we're about to see now is that there's a tradition that there are three exceptional cases where we don't paskin like Rav Shimon Gamliel, and Rabba wants to tell us no, there's only one exception to the rule. This is singular. It's the only case where we don't pass like Rav Shimon Gamliel. Hakamashmalan bahahi, in this particular machlokas, ain halacha ki Rav Shimon Gamliel, but only in this case. Habakulo, in all cases, wherever you find a machlokas between Rav Shimon Gamliel and his colleagues, then halacha ki Rav Shimon Gamliel, and the only single exception is going to be this case of what's called Raya Achrona. Raya Achrona means there were two parts to this Mishnah. In the first part, the Beis Din stipulated that he would have to bring his Raya within 30 days, and Rav Shimon Gamliel is willing to accept his raya even after 30 days. And here we pass like Rav Shimon Gamliel. In the second raya, which is the last one that we just did now, he himself, the litigant, admitted that he had no raya, he had no proof. And in such a case, we pass like the Chachamim against Rav Shimon Gamliel, and we don't accept his evidence that he brings in afterwards. And this is the only case, says Rav Baruch Huna, where we paskin against Rav Shimon Gamliel. Whereas we have a tradition that there are as many as three cases where we reject Rav Shimon Gamliel. This case that we're talking about is one of the three, but there are another two cases, and that's the principle Lafuke Meha. We have a principle. Now let's be careful. Our Gemara is about Rabbi Bar Rav Huna. There's another Rabbi. His name is Rabbi Bar Bar Chana. He also was a Talmud of Rabbi Yochanan. But his tradition has it that Kol Makom Sheshana Rav Shimon Gamliel Mishnasenu Alocha Kemosu Chutz Mi Arei Vitzidon Varaya Chrona. Meaning that there are three cases where we reject Rav Shimon Gamliel. One case is Arev. One case is Tzaydon. And the last case, which is our case, is Raya Achrona, which is the second machlokus in our Mishnah. So Rav Baruch Huna was telling us that according to Rabbi Yochanan, the halacha is like Rav Shimon Gamliel, always, even in the cases of Arev Vitzidon, and the only single exception to the rule is our case, which is called Raya Achrona. And there we reject Rav Shimon Gamliel, and we disqualify any testimony, any evidence that she or he brings in after he or she had already admitted that we have no evidence. So Arev and Sidon are two sugyas. Sidon is actually the name of a place, it's not a halacha, but it indicates a certain scenario, a certain case that took place in the city of Sidon, in which a Baal says to his wife, "Areza gitech al menashe titni li esa itztala shali," which means, "I'm giving you this get, but only on the condition that you return this particular talis." And the talis is no longer. So the question is, can she fulfill this condition by paying its value? And really the intention of this condition was that he would get back either the itztala, this talis, or he would get back its value. And Rav Shimon Gamliel came with a more liberal understanding of this tenai, of this condition, and he was willing to allow her to pay the Baal the value, the market value of this itztala, and she would be megureshes. According to our Rabbah, Rav Baruch Huna, we paskin like Rav Shimon Gamliel, and the get is valid. The condition was fulfilled through payment, even though she cannot return the itztala, it's gone. Whereas, according to this tradition, not of Rabbi Baruch Huna, but Rabbi Bar Chana, we paskin against Rav Shimon Gamliel, and the get is invalid. And the case of Arev has to do with the fact that if a person lends money, can the Arev come along and say, "Malva li parme Arev lahalva," and they're in the chasim in the lova, "Af im ha'arifu arif kablon." Okay, so this is something that we'd have to see in the Gemara Bava Basra, but generally speaking, the halach of an arif, a cosigner, is such that when the cosigner comes to collect, when the malva has to, if he needs to, if he has recourse to collect from the arif, then the question is, does he do so, is he allowed to do so in the following scenario? The lova has what's called b'nei chori. I'm sorry, he has no b'nei chori. He only has nechasim mishubadim, which means that he has. Let's start slowly. In general, a loan is collectible from two different sources. It's collected from b'nei chori, which means either cash or movables, anything that's in the possession of the lova. And it's also collectible from mishubadim, which means from real estate that's leaned. And now the question is, and this is the issue of Arev, does the malva have recourse to go straight to the Arev if the lover who borrowed the money is completely cleaned out of Bnei Chori, can the Arev say to the Malve, well, I don't want to pay you up because you can collect from Mishubadim, from property that was leaned. So for example, let's say the Lova sold a piece of karka. Is anybody following me? So if you know, just to get the gist of it, at what point does the Arev become, you know, front line? Does he become responsible and you can go directly and collect from the Arev? Nobody wants to collect from Bnei Chori, from Mishubadi. I mean, that's a real hassle. You have to get to Lekuchos and to Bezdin, and you have to prove that there was a lien and that their purchase took place after the lien, and there was a Milv Mishtar. It's a whole Chagadya. So it's much more comfortable for the Malva to collect directly from the Arev. On the other hand, the Arev, of course, would really not want to be in that position where he has to pay up the Chov and the Lova, because who knows if he'll ever get his money back. So the issue is, can the Arev push off the Malv and say, you have to collect from Mishubadim. You can't collect from me if the Lova has possessions, or if it's not in, right now he doesn't have it, but he sold it because there's a Shibud Nechosim. So that's a machlokas between Rav Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim. And once again, in this case, we have a machlokas how we paskin. Normally we paskin like Rav Shimon Gamliel, and that's what Rav Baruch Huna is going to assume. He's going to apply that rule here as well, in the case of Arev, but we have a tradition of Rabbi Baruch Hanna in the name of Rabbi Yochanan that we don't paskin like Rav Shimon Gamliel. This is one of the three exceptions to the rule. Okay, now we have a couple of stories here, scenarios. Hahuya Nuka, this was a case of a young heir. In other words, he was an orphan. His father died, left him an estate. And somebody comes now to sue the estate. In this case, to sue the katan. Like, the father is gone. The father had a chov. He had an outstanding debt. And somebody comes to collect the debt from the estate of the children. Tav'inu l'dina kamei d'Rav Nachman. And there was a tviya, there was a litigation and a claim, a lawsuit against the estate, and this the dayan in charge of this decision was Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman now turns to this orphan, and he says to him, "Amalei Islech Sali, do you have any witnesses that your father during his lifetime paid up this loan?" Amalei, so the Yosam says Rav Nachman, "Lo, I have no witnesses." So Rav Nachman goes ahead and asks him another question. Islech Araya, maybe you have a shtar or some sort of shovar. When you pay up a chov, normally what happens is you ask the malva for a receipt. That's called a shovar. Shin vav veiz resh. So maybe amongst the possessions of your father that he left, you'll find, dig up a document, which is a shovar. And that would will allow you to be free of this payment because it would prove conclusively that the loan was already paid off. Amalei lo. Once again, the Yosam says, I don't have anything. So at that point, Rav Nachman had no choice, but chive Rav Nachman bedin, Rav Nachman paskin, that the estate is now responsible to pay up this chov. Havika bachi v'yazil. And the Somim started crying, or this Yosam started crying, because he realized that this was a tremendous sum that would drain his estate. Sham Inu, and the noise went out. You know, everybody heard this Nebuch, this Yosam crying, Hanach Inshi. And amongst the various people that heard the crying, Amrele, there were two who came forward. And they say, Ananya de'inon b'mili davuch. We know exactly what was going on in your father. You know, maybe they were his accountant. You know, so the accountant comes up. He says, I know exactly what happened with this loan. And I want to testify that the loan was paid up. But the only problem is that the Yosam himself had already announced that he has no proof. Rav Nachman Baha, in this case, Afilu Rabbanan Modi, even the Rabbanan. And again, we passing like the Rabbanan, that once the nitba, once the defendant says, I have no evidence, then no backs. That's irretractable. But in this case, we can open up the case. How should I say, reopen the case, and we can change the law, change the decision. And even the Rabbanan who say that in general it's irreversible, why did Diyanuka b'mila davu alo yadi? You know, if we normally suspect someone that if he admits that he has no evidence. All of a sudden he comes up with evidence. Maybe in the meantime, you know, he paid off someone and the whole thing is a fabrication. But in the case of Yanuka, of a young orphan, he doesn't know beans about his father's monetary transactions and dealings. So therefore, even though initially he said Ein lo edim, he was saying it in a naive way. I don't have any witnesses. I don't know anybody who could come forward and support my claim. Now, people are coming forward. We believe they're honest to goodness people, and we can accept them, and even the Rabbanu would accept them. That's the story number one that we have here. Now, there's a gigantic controversy amongst the Rishonim. What happens if this heir was an older, let's call him an adolescent? You know, at what point do we assume that he really knows enough about his father's business transactions that if he admitted at the beginning he doesn't have witnesses and then all of a sudden he finds witnesses, we're not going to be accepting them? So what's clear from Agamar, and that's codified in all the poskim, is that if he's a katan and he's less than bar mitzvah, then we assume he doesn't know what his father's dealings are. But as far as a gadol, it is if he's older than bar mitzvah and various ages are suggested, then it could very well be that we would not allow to reopen the trial and bring in new evidence. Next story. Hahi Issa. Now we're talking about a woman. Hahi Issa did nafak shtara mitusa yada. And she has a shtar chov, and the shtar chov seems to indicate that she owes a certain sum of money. The Amrle, she turns to that somebody else owes her money. That's what I meant to say. Right, so she has a shtar chov. Now, a shtar chov is normally in the hands of whom? The malveh or the loveh? Anybody know? Who normally, if the shtar is effective, is holding on to the shtar? The malveh, the lender, or the
malveh?
Correct, the malveh. So she now is holding on to a shtar. And this shtar, nafik means that it was produced. Literally, nafik means it came out of Tusa Yada, from under her hands. Means she presented it in front of, again, the Dayan in this case was once again Rav Nachman. And here's the deal. We have something called a shlish. I should really write this word down because that's what we're going to have to deal with here. Oh, okay. Anyway, a shlish. Shin, lamed, yud, shin. Okay? I think in English it would be, maybe you'll help me to get the exact word, but when you put money in escrow, so the person holding on to that escrow is called a shlish in Hebrew.
Trustee.
Excellent. So we'll use the word trustee. Now, what happens is that in a case of a shtar chov, you have to have the agreement of both the malveh and the loveh to deposit the shtar in the hands of a trustee. They both have to trust this trustee. Why? Because what's going to happen is that the loveh is going to come and he's going to say, well, the shtar was already paid up. And the trustee is going to say, well, it was already paid up, if he so supports the lover. The malveh, on the other hand, is going to say, well, this hasn't been paid up yet. And he's going to put all his trust in the hands of the trustee of the shlish. So basically, the shlish now is, so to speak, being granted a certain status of nemanus by both the malveh and the lover. Okay. So now let's get back to our Gemara. So the Gemara says the following. Amro Le, she turns to Rav Nachman, and again, we have to know who she is, right? Not by name, I don't mean that. Either she's the malveh, or she's the loveh, or she's the shlish. And from the next line of the Gemara, we're going to be able to clarify this, because the opening line of the Gemara is very ambiguous. It says, "Dinafik shtar mitusei yada." The shtar was produced from her hand, and she was holding on to the shtar. Well, who was she? She says to Rav Nachman, Yadana b'hai shtara d'priya havi. She says that she knows that this shtar was paid up. So who is she? If I could ask you. She's neither the malveh nor the loveh. She's the shlish. Why? Because she was believed to say whether the shtar was actually paid up. And Hemni Rav Nachman. So Rav Nachman therefore believed her, and even though the shtar says that so-and-so owes so-and-so a sum of money, but nevertheless he would not be able to collect with this shtar. Why not? Because she is a shlish, and she's believed to say that the shtar was already paid up. Ole Rava l'Rav Nachman, kiman. Rava says that your verdict, your decision, must be, so to speak, standing on the shoulders of Rebbe, Kir Rebbe. Now here we have a gigantic machlokas between Rebbe and the Chachamim. A malva has a shtar, and he wants to sell the chov. Now when you sell a chov, it's a little bit similar to, if I can give this mashal, to bonds, right? When I buy a bond, I don't pay the full, what's it called, maturity value? Is that how you say it?
Yeah.
I don't pay the maturity value. I only pay a base value, if you want to call it that, which is a fraction of its maturity value. And in halachic terms, the reason why it's such a fraction is more than just that it's not collectible immediately, but also because of the insecurity. Let me see if I can risk. Get a better word. Yeah, the risk element. In other words, in every single shtar, there's always a risk element. The shtar could get lost. The adam could, maybe this, somebody could claim it's a counterfeit. Or it could be that the claim would be that it was already paid up. I mean, and then until you get the person into Bezdin, that also is a hassle. So that when you buy a shtar, you know, when you buy a chov, it's really very tricky. So the value that you pay for that chov is I don't know if it's 50%, whatever percentage it is of the maturity value of the chov. Now there's a machlokas between Rebbe and Chachamim. How do you effectuate a sale of a chov? Now keep in mind that all sales in halacha are what's called a davar sheyesh bo mamish, which means that it's something that exists and something that has mamish. Mamish means it's tangible. So you have a piece of karka, you have metaltalin, you have mos or madbeos. I can actually transfer those to you. How do I transfer a chov? A chov is abstract. It's a debt. So Rebbe came up with a theory, and he abides by this theory. It's called Osios Niknos B'Mesira, which means that if the chov is written in a shtar, then all you have to do is hand over the shtar to the buyer, and now that buyer is the owner of the shtar, and he can use that shtar to collect the chov. Why does that sound fishy to you? If you wanted to be argumentative against Rebbe, what's the deficiency? The Chacham are not going to accept it, so I'm trying to see if I can test your brains. What should gnaw at you here? What should bother you about Rebbe? Osios Niknos B'Mesira.
What bothers me is that if you just hand it over and there's no witnesses, the guy could have broken into your house and stolen it.
Okay, excellent. But I'm going to say it in more conceptual terms, Dale, but it's exactly what you're saying, Bob. I'm going to say the following. That a shtar has to have testimony as a self-contained unit. The evidence of the shtar, better, the testimony. What is a shtar? Shtar is testimony in writing. That shtar has to be testimony, meaning I have to read the names of the malva, the lova, the sum of money, the two witnesses. All this is a story that has to be contained in the shtar. The problem is that when you buy a shtar, how many times, I'm just joking with you, how many times does your name appear in the shtar?
Zero.
And that's where the Chachamim require a whole new shtar, possibly to add to the shtar itself, but that's complicated because the Edom are already signed on the shtar for Reuven the Malveh, and now Reuven is selling it to Yankel Beryl, and Yankel Beryl's name is not mentioned in the shtar. So that Rebbe's chiddush here of Osios Niknos B'Mesira, in a certain sense, it undermines everything we know about shtar. Now keep in mind, shtar, every document, you'll laugh when I say this, but it has its own value as a piece of paper. How much is paper worth, right? It's worth nothing. But that's in contemporary, paper is worth nothing. But back in the day, the paper was parchment. It's another word for parchment in English. It's a vellum. It's some word like that.
Vellum, I think.
Vellum. Vellum. Excellent. I haven't heard that word in 50 years. Vellum. So there's something, it has value, right? You can use it for different things. So everybody agrees, the Chacham will never question that if you sell the shtar, the buyer owns the gufo shel shtar as a chefetz shel mamon. You know, it has its own value. But the question is, what about the chov? I mean, he's not paying $1,000 for the parchment. You know, the parchment may be worth $5. He's paying for the chov. So how can you effectuate a kinyan on the chov by simply handing over, which is called mesira, the shtar itself? Again, if the mesira is effecting a kinyan on the shtar as a cheftes shel mamon, as a piece of paper, a parchment, fine. Mesira is one of your classic kinyanim for metaltolin. But you want to pass over not the shtar, but rather the rayas hashtar, right? The proof of the shtar. The proof of the shtar is called in the Lashon HaShas osios. The letters on the shtar. Again, when I say the letters on the shtar, I don't mean the ink itself as an object, but I mean the meaning of the osios. And that meaning is something abstract, and it doesn't lend itself to kinyan. So Rava is now going to accuse Rav Nachman as holding that osios niknos v'mesira. Why? Because Rav Nachman's going to believe this woman, who is the shlish, to claim that the shtar is a shtar parua. And that's something that only the owner of the shtar could claim. So according to Rava's analysis of Rav Nachman, Rav Nachman was basically saying that when the malva gave over the shtar to the shlish, osios niknos b'mesir, she herself now becomes the owner of the chov. Again, not to claim the chov for herself, but she could claim that chov on behalf of someone else. And this is not good news for Rav Nachman, because if Rav Nachman is predicated on Rebbe, in this case we don't accept Rebbe Shita. So I'll just read to you his Hebrew translation. He says, Shtar Chov, Nikneb, according to Rebbe, Nikneb Mesiras Haosios. What does that mean, Mesiras Haosios? Again, he's not interested in transferring ownership over the Gufa Shtar, but rather over the osel sashtar, which means the raya of the shtar. Chlomar hamocher shtar chov lechavero, kana lokech hasachov, al yidei mesir liyado hasashtar. So the mocher, in this case the malve, hands over the shtar to the third party, and that third party is the buyer, and he buys the chov. That's according to Rebbe. Why? Because mesira, the mesira, which is the kinyan, is effective not just on the gufo shel shtar as a chef shel mamon, but also on the osios, meaning on the chov itself. In kein gam kan, here too, according to Rava's analysis of Rav Nachman, kasher masru liyad liado isha es hashtar, when the shtar was handed over, presumably by the malva, kansa oso, she acquired ownership over the chov. Why? Because Rebbe holds that Mesiras Hashtar is an effective transaction of the chov, in which the chov goes from the ownership of the malve over to the buyer who bought the chov. V'lachain, since she's now the owner of the chov, he nemenes lomar, she certainly should be believed against the to the chagrin of the love, shehu parua, that this chov was paid up. Mishum dahavi kemeid al shalah. It's like she's testifying about her own chov, which comes under the principle of hodas bal din kemeid eidim dami. When a person admits that he has no rights to something that he otherwise would have rights to, and that she could certainly stand in place of the lov and in place of the malv and collect this chov, but she's to. Oh, I said, I'm sorry, I said to the chagrin of the lova, I meant to say to the chagrin, to the disappointment of the malve. She's saying that this chov was paid up. In a certain sense, she's admitting that the chov that she bought is no longer viable. It's already been paid up. And all this makes sense according to whom? According to Rebbe. Why? Because Rebbe holds osios niknos b'mesira. But l'das chachamim, hacholkim al Rebbe, They hold that what? That shtar chov nikne rak al yedei shtar umesira. What that means is that it's not enough to just give over the shtar, but you have to write another shtar, and the second shtar is going to replace the first shtar. Is then lo yadin kach? According to Rava, your psak Rav Nachman is incorrect, because who made her the bailim over the chov that she could tell us that the chov was paid up? The shtar says that the chov wasn't paid up. So again, it was very nice that the malva deposited the shtar in the hands of the shlish, but that doesn't give her rights to completely undermine the testimony in the shtar. So again, at this point, basically Rav is saying that she has no nemanus per se to claim that the shtar was parua. What she has is, if anything, is bailus, that she owns the chov. So according to Rav, the only way that we could believe her to nullify the shtar and its edus is if she's the owner of the chov, which means hodas baldin kibeya edim zon. Well, had she become the owner of the chov? The malva owns the chov, not she. The answer is, we hold like Rebbe, osios niknos b'mesira. The problem is that we don't paskin like Rebbe, and that's why Rav Nachman is sort of like, his back is up against the wall here. Amalei, so Rav Nachman responds, shani hacha, in this case, even the chacham would agree that she, that the word is with her, but not that the word is with her because she owns the chov. Because the chachamim disagree with Rebbe, and there was no separate transaction on the chov that would allow her to acquire the chov. She doesn't own the chov, but rather here we believe her midin nemanus. Nemanus means that a shlish has a certain credibility. The halacha recognizes the word of the shlish as if it was God's word from heaven. Why? And that's based on the svar of Ibai Kalsay. Now I'm going to translate this, and you're going to tell me where we learned almost the identical sugya as what we're learning here. Ibai Kalsay. Ibai Kalsay means that if she wanted a lie and she was fabricating the truth when she says that the lova paid up the chov, and she just simply wants to give him bimafsu the mouth against the law, is if she wanted to do so, she could accomplish that goal with a snap of the finger. Iboy Kalsa, she could destroy the shtar. Rabosai, where did we learn this? Do you remember this? Yeah, what was the case? See if you remember. I'm sort of pressing your memory.
The money in the field.
Correct, excellent. The money in the field. Some guy comes along and tells the Yarshim that I heard from your father that there's a, you know, that he's hiding a bag of coins, and those coins belong to so and so. So why should he be believed to take the money out of the estate of the Yarshim? And the answer is because he by calls, say, not exactly those words, but the Gemara says that if he wanted to, he could just go. Nobody knows where this bag of gold is, of coins is, except for him. He can take it and he can give it to so and so. Nobody would know the darn difference. So that's called the nemunus of biyado. Biyado means that he could achieve his goal if he was lying without having to lie. Just simply nobody would know the difference. Now the malva's claim is predicated on the shtar, but she can now destroy the shtar, and she does so. The malva's out in the cold. He has no way of proving his claim against the lova. And in that case, she would have saved herself a big hassle because she wouldn't have even had to come to Beis Din. She could just simply take a cigarette lighter and light up the shtar, and up it goes up in smoke. And therefore, the malva would never be able to collect the chov. So this is called nemanus shlish, which is a kind of a migu. That if the shlish was lying, all we'd have to do is destroy the evidence, because the evidence was placed and legitimately placed into his hands. So again, what we're saying now is that Rav Nachman's psak, when Rav Nachman paskin that we believe what she's saying, that the shtar is parua, it's already been paid up, and the malva cannot claim any money from the lova with the shtar because the chov was paid up, it's not based on her bailus over the chov. It's not because she had purchased the chov. And that would indicate that we're holding like Rebbe, Osiel's Niknos b'mesira, but rather there's a whole different logical reason, and that is biyado, or iboy kolse, or call it a migu. Now I have a footnote here about migu. Let's see if we can figure it out. It's based on the achronim. He quotes a whole bunch of achronim. He says, "Tainas migu, he taina She'ena toy nemon liton bifnei atzma el shim hayrotzel shaker hayochel liton taina tova kazu umemelu huzocha b'din. So again, a tainas migu means a claim that in and of itself would not be believed, but it's believed because if he was lying, he could have had a better claim. So the fact that he didn't put forward his better claim, that indicates that he's telling the truth. You may remember that when we started this, that was Bab Metzia, I'm confusing. Well, in the beginning of Bab Metzia, the Gemara says that if a person, let's say somebody's suing him for 100 and he admits 50, he has a migu, because if he wanted to lie, he could have denied the whole claim. L'chein anu maminim, we believe, b'mashetan. V'af ishezu, this woman herself, right? Einan emenes liton shtar parua, right? The Chachamim hold that if she didn't acquire ownership of the chav, she doesn't have the nemanis, the credibility to say that the shtar is paid up. But mikol makom, why are we going to believe her? For a different reason, because im hayar etzono l'shaker lanu l'hafsis hamalva, if she was interested in lying, ha'isa sorefes ha'shtar, she would burn the shtar. When we kashalo sarfa also, yeshlanu lomar she'ena m'shakeres v'namin lo shashtar be'emes parua. Okay, Ika Diyami, now we have a different presentation of this, of this Nemanus, the reason why Rav Nachman believed her, or maybe didn't believe her. So again, according to the first Lishna, Rav Nachman relied on her because of Migu di boy kalse, Ika di amri. Others say Lohemni, Rav Nachman did not believe her. Now, if Rav Nachman didn't believe her, then once we have the shtar testifies that the lova borrowed money, and now the malviz has recourse to use the shtar to collect the chov. Amalei Ravel Rav Nachman v'ha iboy kalse. And now we're going to turn to Daf Lamed Aleph Amid Beis. Don't you realize that she should be believed to say there was a shtar parua? Why are you collecting this chov from the lova? If she wanted to lie, she could have just burnt up the shtar. So Rav Nachman turns to Rav and he says the following: Kevan dischazik bebeidina iboy kalse lo amrina. What it means is the following: if she would have put her claim forth before she gave the shtar to Beis Din. Now we go back to the original words of the Gemara. Ha'isisa dinafik shtar mitusa yada. Right, that was the opening line in the Gemara here on Daf Lamed Aleph Amid Aleph. She produced the shtar in front of Beis Din. She made a boo-boo. Why? Because if she was sly, if she was cunning, what she would have done is, she would have said, I have a shtar somewhere, and the shtar is parua. In such a case, he boy kalsi, she could destroy the shtar, but she made a boo-boo. She was too honest, so to speak. What'd she do? She produced the shtar in front of Beis Din. Once Beis Din gets their hands on a shtar, then they have to respect the shtar. They will do everything that they have to do in order to make sure that the shtar is not a counterfeit, to authenticate the signatures on the shtar. And once they do so, then they put what's called a henpek on the shtar. They put a seal of Beis Din, right, that certifies that they checked out the shtar. And now she no longer has a migu. Why? Because what do you mean? She's going to break into Beis Din now and burn the shtar? She's already given up possession over the shtar. So once we've gotten to that stage where Beis Din has not only possession over the shtar, because she brought it to the Beis Din, but also they authenticated the shtar through what's called kiyum hashtaros, then she no longer has a migu. Okay, let's just see. There's a Rashi here, de ischazek, on the top of the page, a kosubo henpek. So henpek is the seal of Beis Din, and it means that the three judges who presided over the case will certify that this shtar is an authentic shtar. At this point, says Rashi, lo alima ihi, she doesn't have the power, lafkue maisa Beis Din. She cannot be mafkia, meaning she can no longer vilify, or not vilify, what's the word, when she can no longer disqualify the act of Bezdin. Once Bezdin got actively involved with a henpeg, Rashi calls that a Maisa Bezdin, then she no longer has the ability to undermine a Maisa Bezdin. Now this sugya might have to do with what's called a migulim afreya. A migulim afreya means that yesterday I had a migu, today I no longer have the migu. Can I be believed today because yesterday I could have said it and yesterday I would have had a migu? And this Gemara would now establish that migulim afreya lo amrina. You know, it's when you make the claim, now we have to know if you, at this particular moment you have the migu. The fact that yesterday, before you brought the shtar into Bezdin, you could have and would have and should have claimed what you claim, and therefore you would have been believed with a migu, that's irrelevant. We need that right now, at this moment, we have an urgent need that she should be believed with a migu, and she no longer has that koach hanemonus.
So if she had not brought it into court, she would have been believed it even under...
Correct.
So she would have been believed whether she said it was invalid or she said it was paid off in both cases. Okay.
Because again, she could just burn the shtar, but the problem is she brought the shtar into Bezdin. Bezdin already now, you know, the claws of Bezdin, so to speak, grab onto the shtar. They now put on their active, you know, Bezdin hats, and as in the capacity of Bezdin, they have to look at the shtar and decide whether the shtar is a valid shtar. After they decide whether the shtar is valid or not, now they're open to all sorts of claims and counterclaims about the shtar. But the only thing is that the counterclaim against the shtar here in this case, once it's authenticated, is parua, that it's already been paid up, and we don't believe a person who says that the shtar is paid up unless that person has a migu. But right now it's a little bit late for the migu. Now all this is according to Rashi, Dibra Maskil de Ischazik. But if you take a look at Tosfos, Dibra Maskil came with Ischazik, he says, Pirush HaKudshe Shekosu Bo Henpeg. So why does Rashi put all the emphasis on Henpeg here? Meaning, if she has the ability to destroy the shtar, you know, even after Bezdin put a henpeg on it, which, let's say, for example, after the henpeg, Bezdin says, well, you're the shlish, and the malvin and the lova, you know, gave you the shtar, we'll give you back the shtar. So she still has the body kalsi. Why is the henpeg, you know, why does that close the door in a final way, you know what I mean, by a final way on the migu? Unless Tosis means that migul umafrei amrina, maybe since she had a migul yesterday before the henpeg. But let's just read one more line in Tosis and then we'll go back to his kasha. V'yesh lomar v'schazek gavidina shera'u biyada. What the Gemara means is not henpeg. What the Gemara means is that Bezdin laid eyes on the shtar, and while she was possessing the shtar, she showed the shtar to Bezdin. They saw the shtar. Once they saw the shtar, that's already called huchzak bebezdin. Huchzak bebezdin means that Bezdin knows about the shtar. They're aware of the shtar. And hurry boy kalse, it doesn't make any sense because they already saw the shtar. Once they saw the shtar, it's like registered in their minds, you know, in the memory of Bezdin. So what I'm going to do now, after we answer a couple of questions, is I'm going to read to you an entire presentation of the Chassam Sofer to understand the Rashi and Tosfos here in the sugya. Yeah.
We're still under the concept of evidence, re'eah or not. Right? In other words, the fact that we're talking about a shlish, we're not in the area of a rab, a guarantor. We're still talking about presentation of evidence, which in this case is the shtar.
Right, we're not talking about an orev, if that's what you mean, a cosine. Yes. Right. No, this sugya has nothing to do with a cosine. Our sugya is...
No, not cosine, a guarantor. We're not talking... Yeah. There were three exceptions.
I call it a cosine, right.
There were three possible exceptions. One was the evidence itself, a guarantor or sidon. So we're still in the concept of evidence, which is...
Not really, no. Don. Evidence, the issue of evidence is when a litigant says, I have no evidence.
Right.
Can we believe that litigant when they come back and produce evidence? That's not our discussion. This sugya here is a sugya of shlish. We're really starting a whole new sugya here. And the question is, does shlish have nemanus? If the shlish is the owner of the chov, and that would mean that we're activating the principle of osios niknos b'mesira, then the shlish is saying it's parua, then we believe the shlish. On the other hand, maybe the shlish could be believed because of Iboy Kalse, this migu, that if the shlish was lying, then all the shlish would have to do is alight the shtar. That's the sugya that we're doing.
What confuses me is that we started off by saying, mm-hmm. you know, that there were three exceptions to Rav Gamliel.
Right.
And one of them was Re Achroma, another one was Arev, and the third one was Tzidom, whatever Tzidom means.
Right.
So we started off the Gemara by talking about Rei Achrona.
Correct, but
then we went into Shlish. So I'm trying to
I'll tell you the whole connection is, you remember the story of the child who initially said that he didn't have any evidence.
Yes.
That was connected to the previous sugya. Who was the judge who presided over that decision?
Okay.
Do you remember his name?
Rav Nachman.
Exactly, Rav Nachman. not Rav Nachman from the old city. As soon as he is Rav Nachman, he thinks of the old city. No, so the same Rav Nachman presided over a different case that has nothing to do with anything we discussed until now. That has to do with the shlish.
Okay. It's just because there's another Rav Nachman, so they brought it in.
Another psaka of Rav Nachman.
Right.
The two verdicts of Rav Nachman on two different cases.
Right.
The first verdict is relevant to the debate between Rav Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim about the person who initially says, I have no evidence, and Rav Nachman says, well, in this case it's an orphan, and the orphan didn't know about his father's business dealings. Now we have another verdict of Rav Nachman, with an attack of Rav against that verdict, and Rav Nachman says, we're going to believe the shlish. And Rava says, you're basing yourself on Osios Niknos B'Mesira, but that's Rebbe Shita, we don't accept Rebbe Shita. So Rav Nachman comes back and he says, no, I wasn't basing myself on her acquisition of the shtar, I was basing myself on her ne'manus, and we have reason to believe that what she's saying is true, because if she was a no good liar, she would have just burnt up the shtar. Now we have another approach, in which we're saying that Iboy Kolsi doesn't apply in this case, and in fact, Rav Nachman did not believe her. He allowed the Malva to use the shtar and collect from the Lova because, and now we have Rashi Shita, that the Bezdin got a hold of the shtar. They investigated the authenticity of the shtar. They decided that it was a perfectly reliable, authentic shtar, and she no longer has the ability to undermine that decision of Bezdin and disqualify the shtar. That's where we're holding now. Now, let me ask you a question. I mean, it's a ridiculous question, but just to make sure we're all on the same. If Bezdin puts a henpeik on the shtar, as Rashi claims, is that shtar still flammable? Can you still burn the shtar?
Sure.
Yes. I mean, the fact that you know, there are, I don't know, perhaps some today and now in modern technology, maybe there's certain what do we call them? Certain things that could protect the shtar from burning. I don't know. Some sort of protective...
Fire retardant. Yeah.
What are they called?
Fire retardant.
Yeah. But that's not what we're talking about. I mean, she could still burn the shtar even after the henpeik that was put on the shtar. The question is, does she have access to that shtar? That's what seems to be the issue. Tosis seems to think that she still has access to the shtar even after Bezdin puts the henpeik on. And she could still burn the shtar. Again, I don't know exactly, you know, how to work that out. When and why would Bezdin give her access to the shtar? It would seem to me that Rashi is claiming that once the shtar was produced in front of Bezdin, and Bezdin now attached the henpeik, she no longer has access to the shtar. So we don't have this migu diboy kal say that she could destroy the shtar. But Tosis thinks that she could still burn the shtar even after the henpeik was put on the shtar. So what does Tosfos substitute? He says, "Dischazik beidina shero hadayonim es hashtar biyada." They witnessed. They saw the shtar even when it was still in our hands. V'imkein shuv eini yechol sarfo. She can no longer burn it and deny that this star existed because they saw the star. It's like today you can take a little picture of it, right? So they took a picture of the star. That's what we should be doing every time we get a hold of a star. Take a picture of it. I take a picture of notes of mine, so if I remind myself that I have a doctor's appointment, I take a picture of the thing because I know that I'm going to lose the piece of paper. Okay.
It doesn't matter though. If she burns it, it doesn't matter now, right? Because the
correct.
Has already seen.
Because Beis Din has seen the star, and they have a picture of the star. I'm using that as a mashal, as right. A simile.
Right.
Is Mimela, she doesn't have a migu that she can destroy the star, because even if she destroys the star, Beis Din already has a picture of the star.
If Beis Din has the star, and Beis Din loses the star, they still. Unless they,
I don't know. I don't know. You're asking an excellent question, but the point is that somehow, you know, if Beis Din takes let's say they take a photocopy of the star and they saw the star, it wasn't just that somebody came in with a photocopy. I guess the star is valid.
Is the henpecked done with two edim from
three judges?
Three judges. So we have the three.
Right.
Something bothers me about this.
So you know what? I'll tell you what.
It
could be that our issues will be resolved as soon as we see the Chassam Sofer. The Chassam Sofer is going to hopefully save the day for us. So let's see what's going on over here. Okay. So again, all our energies now, our attention should be focused on three words in the Gemara. Ischazek bebei dina. What does that mean? Ischazek bebei dina. Rashi identifies it as henpeg, and Tosis identifies it as the Beis Din saw the star. Hakavana, again we're talking about Tosus. Shero hatayonim sashtar. Beis Din saw the star. Even when it was in our possession, they saw the star according to Tosus. Right? There's no henpeg on the star. V'im kein, once Beis Din sees the star, shuv eini yecholo l'sarfo. She no longer has the power to burn it. Meaning she could burn it, but it won't be relevant. Ulahakish as a star, and now to deny the star because we already, so to speak, registered the star. V'enkan el amigu l'mafreya, meaning she only has a migu yesterday before Beis Din saw the star. Klomar he I saw yecholal l'sarfo lifnei sheraou Beis Din, but la'akshav he v'akesh shenamin la shehu parua. She wants us to believe her that it was paid up, and she no longer has that migu. She says, well, you know, yesterday, if I would have made this claim that it was paid up, you would have believed me because I had a migu. So now, just because you saw the shtar, if I lose my migu?
Right.
So the answer is, migu l'mafrei alo amrinon. We don't say migu of yesterday. Meaning, we're not going to ask what you could have claimed yesterday. We want to know if your claim today is correct, and do you have a migu today? And he says, "Mevur b'baba basra." So the Chassam Sofer quotes the Gemara b'baba basra. She'eno remigu l'mafreya. We don't say migu today for yesterday. That yesterday you would have been believed with a migu. Chlomar ne'monah shel migu hu rak ba'ofen shu toin akshav taino u'bim koma ha'yochel. To replace it, he could have claimed a better taino, but it doesn't apply ba'ofen shu toin akshav taino. She yochel hoya be'avar liton taina acheres. If his taina today is not reliable, but what are you going to say? Well, in the past I could have put in a different taina and I would have been believed. That's not relevant to today's claim because today it's already too late for that migu. Vatamhu shelifneisha ba lebezdin lo helso bedaito shetitz tarech lekach. The achshav kshirotza liftos halove kvar eina yechol lisof es hashtar v'eina yechol lasos dovar milvad liton shehu parua l'chein ein lo migu. So he's saying that even though before she came to Beis Din, or before Beis Din saw the star, she could have burnt up the star, but you know what? She didn't dream of burning up the star. She thought that she'll come into Beis Din with the star, and she'll claim that the star was, you know, in favor of the lova, the star was already paid up. But the problem is, to say the star was paid up, you have to have special evidence for that. And now she no longer has the migu. Again, yesterday she had a migu. But migu, l'mafreya, lo amrinon. She doesn't have a migu today. So the Chassam Sofer wants to make some sense out of Rashi here. Because again, according to Tosis's claim, even after the henpeg, she still has the migul. He says, "Vaday poshet al loshen ischazik beidina mashma henpeg." Kipirush Rashi. Rashi was very, loyal to the simple reading of the text. And ischazik beidina is a phrase that appears all over Shas, and it always indicates a henpeg. Is vaday shemigu moil keneged maisa bezdin? Tosis is right that if she still has a migu, that migu would be believed despite the henpeg. El shekan gam Rashi moda shekeman shero bezdin sashtar hareiz a migu l'mafreya. Interesting that some sofer wants to claim that although Rashi interprets, or shall I say, translates ischazik beidina as henpeg. Henpeg is the seal. I don't know, you'll give me a word for it in English. I don't know. I think it's a Greek word, henpeg. Anyway, the henpeg, that's the translation of ischazik beidina. Wherever you see ischazik beidina, just plug in the word henpeg. That's what ischazik beidina means. It means a henpeg, that seal of Bezdin that it testifies to the validity of the shtar. But Rashi admits that we're talking about a case where Bezdin saw the shtar, because how could Bezdin put a henpeg on the shtar unless they saw the shtar? And therefore Rashi would agree that the reason why she forfeits her credibility, her nemanus, is because it's a migul of Afreya. So the logic of Tosfos was acceptable to Rashi as well. Rashi was only focusing on the literal translation of the Gemara. But what the Gemara is really implying here is that if there was a henpeg, then by definition, did the Bezdin see the shtar? Yes, no, maybe?
Yes.
Again, if there was a henpeg on the shtar, yes, no, and maybe.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
True or false? Bezdin must have seen the shtar.
Right. Right.
True, right? So Rashi, like Tosfos, is based... In other words, the reason why she doesn't have believability, she doesn't have the credibility of Migu, is based on the fact that the Dayanim saw the shtar. Again, why does Rashi mention henpeg? Because Rashi is translating the Gemara of Ischazik Beidina. So that's just the reality, that's just the way of transmitting the reality that the Bezdin saw the shtar. Once the Bezdin saw the shtar, she no longer has a Migu. Because even if she would destroy the shtar at this point, Bezdin doesn't need her anymore, because they already, as we said before, they took a picture of the shtar. So Rashi is also operating with the principle, as we saw in the Gemara in Bab Basra, migu l'mafreya lo amrina. The fact that yesterday, before Bezdin saw the shtar, she had a migu, that doesn't give a migu to her today. Right? Today it's too late. V'gam Rav Nachman moda bazeh. Just 1 second. What does that mean? V'gam Rav Nachman moda bazeh. Wasn't it Rav Nachman who said that she's not believed? Just 1 second. Rav Nachman said we don't believe. So what does he mean? Gam Rav Nachman. I'm not sure what he means here. Sorry. Gam Rav Nachman moda bazeh. El shesovar shekan meduba shekimu bezin es ashtar. Ulemigul mafreya ein koch lafkia mi maisa bezin. Tochiach Rava Mehabraisa Sheshlish Neman Afil Afkia Mimaisa Bezdin. Just 1 second. Not sure what he means here. Give me a second here to work out. I don't know, it's the mathematics here, it doesn't click for me. He says, since Bezdin saw the shtar, it's a Migul Mafreya. Rashi holds that what? That a shlish has nemanus. Oh, wow. Now I'm beginning to understand because I'm so fair. Let me just stretch my feet here and I hope I don't hit anybody here, please. let me know if I'm in your way. Oh, says looks, I'm so fair. Wow. What's he saying? He's saying the following. Let's say on a scale of 0 to 100 for nemanus, you could have 0 nemanus, you could have 100% nemanus, we rely on you, we trust you, etc., etc. But you could be somewhere in the gray area in the middle. So you could have a scale that goes from 0 up to 100. And he says the following, that what we could do is, we could add A plus B. Let's say you have A, which is, let's say, 40%, 40 points of nemunis on a scale of 0 to 100. That's not enough. But you have B, which also has a scale of Loma Zogin, 40 nekudos, 40 points up to the 100. If somebody combines both, and he has both A and B, then we add 40% to 40%, they have 80% nemunis. And that's enough to swing the case. Says the Chasam Sofer, we have two variables here, two powers of nemunis, each of which alone would not suffice. But when we combine them together, right, two is better than one, then you produce nemunis. Now what's the A and what's the B? Says the Chasam Sofer, there's something called shlish. Shlish gets nemunis simply by the very fact that both the Malva and the Lova agreed to hand over the shtar into the hands of this trustee, as you call him. So that itself gives that trustee a certain element in their monis vis-a-vis this halva, this loan. It might not be enough in and of itself, but we could add migu. And if we add migu, then it might tip the scale. Why? So first, says the Chasam Sofer, migu per se would not be good enough. Why? Because Beis Din saw the shtar. The very moment that Beis Din saw the shtar, and Rashi says we know that Beis Din saw the shtar because they put a hepek on the shtar, ha-migu becomes a second-rate migu. It's a migu l'mafreya. Migu l'mafreya means, well, yesterday I had a migu, so I would have been believed yesterday, believe me today. Knapper migu. It's not a first-class migu. But says the Chasam Sofer, when you add nemunis of shlish together with this migu l'mafreya, which is a weak kind of a migu, you produce a nemunis.
Which means she should be believed.
And she should be believed.
That was my problem. Oh.
So here's where Rashi comes up with a kosav ashlishi, a third, you know, the resolution to this problem. Rav Nachman says we're not going to believe her in this lishna, the lishna vasra. And the Malva is going to collect the loan. So why not? So Rashi says, like Tosfos, that Beis Din already saw the shtar. And I'll prove it to you, because there's a henpek on the shtar. That makes her migu into a migu lemafreya. It's a second-rate migu. Mm-hmm. But she's a shlish. And if she's a shlish, and we know that both the Malva and the Lova deposited the shtar in her possession, that means they gave her a certain element of trustability. That together with a migu, even if it's a migu l'mafreya, is going to give her, tip her, push her over the ledge, and she should be believed.
This is the Chasam Sofer on Rashi, or this is Rashi?
On Rashi. This is the Chasam Sofer interpreting Rashi. Again, he's 1,000 years after Rashi. I'm exaggerating, but 900 years. I don't know how many years he is after Rashi. You can check it out.
Okay.
Says the Chasam Sofer. That's where Rashi introduces Maisa Beis Din. Let's look at Rashi one more time. Rashi says, Lo alima ihi lafkue Maisa Beis Din. She doesn't have the authority, the power. Lafkue means to destroy, to undermine a Maisa Beis Din. You see those two words, Maisa Beis Din, the last two words in Rashi on the second line from the top? Please underline those two words. This is the thesis of the Chasam Sofer, Maisa Beis Din. Rashi feels that the Gemara deliberately mentions this chazek b'beit dina. Why? Because it was a henpek. Not just to prove that Beis Din saw the shtar. Tosa says, why is Rashi introducing henpek? It's irrelevant. She could still burn the shtar. No. Tosa says henpek is only to prove that Beis Din saw the shtar, and that reduced her migu to migu l'mafreya. Says that some Sofer, Rashi wasn't satisfied with Tosa's, because Rashi felt that even if she only has a migu l'mafreya because Beis Din saw the shtar, nevertheless she should be believed. Why? Because she's a shlish. And when I add shlish plus migu l'mafreya, the two together create a nemonus. Ah, you know why Rav Nachman says we can't believe her? Maisa Bezdin. There's a separate halacha, a new halacha, that says that once Bezdin gets involved and they do a Maisa Bezdin, which in this case is creating a henpeg, then the shtar is valid on its own.
The henpeg is before or after she presents it?
Well, again,
it was already there.
The henpeg means that the shtar was, it came in from the Bezdin. Bezdin looked at the shtar. They sent around a WhatsApp. You know, who can tell me something about the Edom who assigned the shtar? Is anyone who can attest to the veracity and the authenticity of the signature of the shtar? And the witnesses came in, they said, we know that's his John Hancock. At that point, Bezdin puts a henpeg on the shtar. Rashi says it's not enough that Bezdin saw the shtar, like Tosus says, because that alone would not undermine her believability, because she has a Migul Mafreya. Although Migul Mafreya is not reliable, but for a Shlish it is reliable. The answer is Bezdin went one step further and they put the henpeg on the shtar. Once they put the henpeg on the shtar, there's a Chal Hashem Maisa Bezdin. And once it's a Maisa Bezdin, then she doesn't have the authority to undermine the Maisa
Bezdin. Is this only the case where she's claiming it's invalid, or also where she's claiming it was fake?
If she says it's invalid, no one would believe her. I don't even have nothing for that. Even Berzon will tell you that she's not believed. Because once we validate the shtar, she can't say that the shtar is a bluff.
I'm still bothered by whether she presents it or doesn't.